are in San Diego. We're actually at the Grand Hyatt Hotel, just down the street from the Convention Center, which is host, as we speak, to the Society for Neuroscience annual meeting. Tens of thousands of neuroscientists milling all over the street. But yesterday, there was a satellite meeting of the Neuroethics Society. And I have with me Stephen Hyman, who's actually the president of the executive committee of the Neuroethics Society, as well as being provost of Harvard and a former director of the Institute of Mental Health and several other things that we'll get to as we go along, including the, are you chair of the board of editors of the annual reviews of neuroscience?
I'm the editor of the annual review of neuroscience.
So
yes.
You have a few hats and we'll deal with them. But let's go back for a moment to the Neuroethics Society and give me some sense, if you would, of where you think it's got to and what the trajectory you'd like to see.
Yes, yes. So we needed a name, and the term neuroethics had already been coined and had been popularized after a conference organized by the Dana Foundation some years before. But it's important that neuroethics not be construed simply as traditional bioethics, looking at issues like informed consent and so forth, with a neuro twist. I think we have to be much broader, meaning in addition to medically oriented issues, we should be thinking about how neuroscience influences our concepts of identity, of personal responsibility, how society should think about the ability we might have one day to provide cognitive enhancement to people who are well, to manipulate fundamental moral emotions like trust, which in the laboratory is already to some degree possible.
And so the oxytocin story.
The oxytocin story. And so my notion of neuroethics is that neurobiology and related aspects of psychology should be at the core, but that really needs deep engagement with philosophers, social scientists, people from the law, because it's just critical that there be both science literacy among the people who, in many ways, day to day, are running the important activities on our planet, that they be in a position to incorporate sensible and often also challenging developments from neuroscience, to reject as premature hucksterism, which we see with some aspects of neuroeducation or excessive claims for some aspects of neuroimaging, and fundamentally to be part of a larger community engaged in human self-understanding.
Right, now, so, but how precise do you want, how sharp do you want the point on this to be, in a sense? In the sense that you could look at these issues like President's Commission recently did some hearings on synthetic life,
mm-hmm.
Craig Venter came in and so on.
Yes, absolutely.
So there's end of life
yes,
issues.
Yes, absolutely.
There's stem cell issues,
yes.
There's, as you said, cognitive enhancement issues. Many of these things are practical bench to bed or just, mm-hmm. just straight bench to mm-hmm. society issues. Do you nevertheless want it to remain tethered to the large moral landscape, to use Sam Harris's current term? In other words,
yeah. The answer is yes. And while there are these ultimately the interest outside of neuroscience per se is a connection to ethically challenging issues or policy relevant issues or practical issues of the kind that you've just mentioned. You know, should we permit the use of cognitive enhancement in people who are well? Ultimately, this will be a practical issue. How should we regulate drugs or other interventions that might alter interpersonal trust? These will be practical issues. But the answers shouldn't be dealt with in a shallow fashion. I mean, the answers really come from a sense of how do we think about, how do we regulate our social interactions as human beings? And scientists by themselves don't have the answers. We need to engage, again, philosophers, social scientists, frankly, even, literature, religion, because all of these viewpoints are going to matter. You know, sometimes as a university provost with a university that has a really very substantial, indeed a great stem cell program involving maybe 140 labs, quite at the cutting edge, there are a lot that we were faced, as you can imagine, with a lot of ethical challenges. And very often you would ask profound questions and people were only prepared to give shallow answers. Now, I have no desire to clone human beings, but if you ask most people, why don't we want to clone human beings, their answer would be, well, that would be disgusting, or, you know, we shouldn't think about it because if we proposed it, we would be shut down. Yeah. But again, the really deep answers come from a profound engagement with our whole cultural patrimony and not simply from the brief exhalations of our brainstems giving glib answers.
Yeah. Paul Root Welpy was just, had a conversation with him, and I mentioned two things. One, that we'd just done a panel on the origins of morality at ASU with Steve Pinker.
Another very profound issue.
Peter Singer,
right,
and,
yes.
And Simon Blackburn, Pat Churchland, who spoke yesterday at your meeting, of course. Sam Harris, Lawrence Krauss, and others. So I read there this opinion special from New Scientist, 16 October, a very recent piece written by Fiery Cushman, who has a paragraph in here which says, "We've long thought of moral laws as fixed points of reality, self-evident truths rooted in divine command or in some platonic realm of absolute rights and wrongs." And you're a philosopher going back, of course. "But new research is offering an alternative explaining moral attitudes in the context of evolution, culture, and the neural architecture of our brains. This apparent reduction of morality to a scientific specimen can seem threatening, but it needn't. Rather, by unmasking our minds as the authors of morality, we may be better able to bend its narrative arc towards a happy end." What's your take on that? And then I'll tell you what Paul's saying.
Well, look, you know, I am, you know, to my core, a scientist and therefore a brute materialist. And I have no doubt but that our morality is shaped by the evolution of our brains. You know, we see the world through our evolved sensory organs. We process it through our brains. I think it would be the height of foolishness to think that morality, which after all changes over time, it wasn't that many years ago in different parts of the world, and not many thousands of years ago in the entire world, when slavery was considered a perfectly moral thing to do. So morality changes over time, but it would be really quite terrible if we were not humble enough to realize that our current, even strongly held moral view of the world is partly the product of our brains with all of their great strengths, but also their limitations. Now, what's important is to recognize that these things shouldn't bind us. We shouldn't fall into the naturalistic fallacy. We shouldn't say, you know, what is what ought to be. We also have this wonderful cerebral cortex, which helps us think about things and think through and alter our own predilections or our own initial intuitions. Mm-hmm. Far be it from me to know how this comes out over time. The bottom line, sounds like I'm agreeing with Fiery Cushman, a fine Harvard-trained thinker, that we had better take the evolved brain-based nature of our moral vision into account. But we shouldn't therefore fall into a kind of passivity or pessimism or into the naturalistic fallacy.
Yeah. So Pat's talk, Patricia Churchland's talk yesterday, the opening address, "What Role Do Rules Play in Navigating the Social World?" She was talking about building a platform for morality, if you like, from such things as trust and oxytocin and so on. And Paul's take on that was that he thought that Fiery's piece had a certain amount of hyperbole in there, that he thought that we still had to to draw upon these, what you call the patrimony, the long history of
culture,
culture,
religion.
The wisdom of faiths
yes,
as well.
Yes, absolutely. Yes.
So you don't have a problem with that?
I don't. But again, as I think what that the hard thing to negotiate is the fact that these are not absolute givens. Mm. Either what comes bottom up from our genes as a product of evolution, nor what putatively comes top down from religious dictate or putative natural law. And that's very challenging. People in different periods of history, and many people in our own period, look toward absolutes. They look toward reductive single readings of religious documents, whether the mm-hmm. Bible or the Quran, or for that matter, the United States Constitution, when these are clearly very complicated documents derived from human history. And you know, we have to find, I think, in a world where there is no omniscient and omnipotent God, the right way to behave, respecting and taking into account both, again, our nature as biological evolved creatures, but also learning from the better wisdom of our long cultural history.
You bring a lot of disciplines together, which is why I'm glad that we've had a chance to talk. But let's actually go back to the beginning, because you actually started with philosophy and the humanities, didn't
yes,
you?
Yes, yes.
And then a Mellon Fellow yes, in Philosophy yes. of Science.
Right.
Before that, can you recall what drove you at all in this direction?
Yeah.
Even as a kid, was there
yes,
a
yeah.
parents,
no,
teacher, book?
No, you know, it's interesting. My parents thought I should be a doctor in private practice, and that was the highest form of being. I was interested in our various predicaments as human beings, including my own. You know, how did I come to be this way, and where does happiness come from, and pain come from?
How old were you about this?
Oh, probably early adolescence. It was also the time that I started negotiating a separation from traditional religion. And here, conservative Judaism, as it was practiced, at least in the United States at the time, was very useful. I was about to be bar mitzvahed. I was a very good student. You know, I knew my prayers and my haftorah and everything, you know. But I said to the rabbi who was drilling me, you know, in this, who was this very warm and understanding man, Rabbi Kleinman, this is all terrific, but I'm afraid that I don't believe in God. And he looked at me in this wonderful avuncular way and he said, oh, that's not a problem. You know, just follow the rules, be a good person, be ethical, and do the chants and all will be fine. And, you know, it was this wonderful answer at one level. At another level, it's quite confusing. You know, why are we going through this ritual? And I came to the perhaps superficial, place that there was this very powerful emotional connection with my parents, my family, my forebears. There was a connection with a community that came by, you know, singing prayers, but only with the old tunes that I had learned as a child, you know, in a congregation. But that in terms of facing the world, I was going to do it, you know, without God. And I was just somebody who was always questioning and worrying. You know, maybe I had a small version, well compensated and well hidden, of what the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders calls oppositional defiant disorder, you know. I, from the time I was, you know, into high school, I actually thought that I was going to be an academic philosopher or to study intellectual history. And I was well on my way. I mean, after my undergraduate education and my years at the University of Cambridge, But it felt that I started to feel this disquiet that that the philosophy of the mid-1970s didn't quite always seem to want to grapple with these important questions that were troubling me. The sort of analytic philosophy of that period was a bit in the doldrums, and the late Heidegger, which was dominating continental philosophy, this is too reductive, but you know, seemed not to get me to the right place either. And I said, I know, I always really wanted to understand where this comes from, and I think it may well be the brain. So then I took the circuitous route. I couldn't have applied to graduate school in biology with my basically fundamentally humanities record. So how better to do it than to go to medical school, where in the United States, if you could put together the right science courses and take some standardized tests, you could go to medical school. And so that's what I did.
So your parents got their wish.
Yeah, well, they did. Almost. But then I actually then trained clinically, even though I spent most of my life in the lab, I trained clinically in psychiatry. And that they just thought was terrible. My mom always said, you know, you should never talk to a psychiatrist. They always blame the mother. And my father, who was an internist, wasn't sure that this was a profession in medicine particularly. So I sort of won. And then I, following my plan, I actually then did a 5-year postdoctoral fellowship in molecular biology and was doing molecular biology. And perhaps I will again, but I've taken a bit of an administrative detour, convinced to run an NIH institute for a while.
Who actually were your sort of philosophers you were most interested in? You would be most the ones that are being thrust upon.
No. I was actually very interested in a number of things, but the period in the 16th and 17th century, as people moved from received authority to skepticism and to science, while I think that, you know, people like Descartes have there are many things in Descartes that one appropriately disagrees with, but I think, you know, the questioning attitude, in fact, he for a minute there thought himself right out of the universe almost, right? Was very, very interesting to me.
This, of course, is the 350th anniversary year of the Royal Society's formation. So there was a lot of ferment leading up to that. Oldenburg, of course, was the first secretary.
Yes.
He was going over to the continent. He was meeting with Spinoza.
Yes.
Descartes, the correspondence.
And actually, you know, a very interesting figure to me is Michel de Montaigne. You know, how can you in the 16th century really become a skeptic and think about yourself in context? These were very courageous people. In some parts of the world, even today, you can be killed for asking less probing questions than some of these people ask.
But when you were sort of passed over the molecular biology so on, but the psychiatry work at Harvard Medical School, you spend a lot of time on dopamine.
Yeah, that's right. So
and one of the sessions yesterday that you were in was actually on addiction.
Yes.
With George Kuhn.
Yes, that's right.
And so on.
Right.
So tell me a little story about this.
Yeah. So the science I did was you know the used mostly molecular tools, but I was interested in this neurotransmitter dopamine, which plays certainly not the only, but a critical role in motivated behavior, and has other roles in the brain as well. And pathologies related to dopamine give rise or contribute to the symptoms of schizophrenia, but also are very intimately involved in addictions. And the lab you know, beginning in the late 80s and through the 90s, worked on how dopamine contributed to brain plasticity, that is, changes, long-lived changes in brain function, by looking at the way in which dopamine and similarly acting drugs activated gene expression in the brain, the signaling pathways that were influenced, and then what genes and what proteins were induced by dopamine arriving in the forebrain. And then we started to analyze, you know, what some of those proteins did and how they interacted with other proteins, and were generally putting together a story which, together with work by colleagues looking at physiologic measures, at changes in synaptic connections owing to dopamine signaling, began to build a story of how addictive drugs, although, you know, potentially other kinds of experiences, could alter brain function, leading to compulsive behavior and loss of control. One interesting sidelight, because the lab really was a molecular lab, but I at the Massachusetts General Hospital in the early 90s, there were people who were among the first to work out ways of using functional magnetic resonance imaging. And even though I was not qualified by experience, I somehow got a grant with a large team to begin to look at at signs of changes in circuits, activation of circuits in response to drugs and emotion in the forebrain. And we actually had some papers related to the nucleus accumbens, this key part of the brain involved in motivated behavior responding to cocaine, which was just really a very interesting sort of larger biological and circuit framework within which to do this more molecular work. And, you know, I think this work has been truncated by my falling down the administrative well for a bit, but it contributed with many other labs to a picture of the neurobiology of addiction that is emerging today.
And fits with the neuroethics society.
And it
of course,
fits entirely. I mean, yeah.
So, because you know, the session that you were talking about, and that George Kube was talking about as well. You said one thing yesterday. You said, which is sort of interesting. You said diagnosis is not absolution. Do you remember
the context was for that? Maybe you could
flesh that out for me.
Yeah. So. You know, there's no question but that by any modern standard view of what is a disease, and I don't want to get into the details of that, drug addiction is a disease. There are now well-established pathological changes in the brain that correlate pretty well with loss of control over drug taking and failure of cognitive top-down control, that it's a control behavior. Interestingly, there are some people who are very upset with the notion of a disease model. What they don't see is that a disease model is what permits people to get treatment that's reimbursed by insurance. And so there's a very, not only is it by our definitions correct, but it also is very pragmatically important. If people are going to be treated in a health system, they have to be ill. But what they're worried about is that a disease model somehow absolves people of all responsibility. So if you think that addiction is a disease, you know, they think it means, well, doc, you know, I'd like to control myself, but you see, I'm just a helpless tool of my DNA or of my brain made me do it, you know. And, you know, that is not at all the case. The diagnosis, as I said, is not absolution. I think what we understand is that there are different kinds of brain diseases, as late stage Alzheimer's disease, where, you know, somebody really can't be held responsible for what they're doing. And there's no time in the future, because sadly without treatment, this is a unidirectional decline. They're not going to be responsible. Addicted people, even severely addicted people, have not become zombies. Indeed, there are symptoms and lack of control. And this is an interesting result of the science, tend to wax and wane depending on whether they're intoxicated, whether they're withdrawing, whether they're in a window of sort of calm when, you know, the last dose of a drug has not worn off so much that they're withdrawing, but they're no longer intoxicated. The fact is that you can engage them, you can ask them to take responsibility. Very often, some kind of coercion is involved in getting addicted people to treatment. Coercion can be from, you know, family members, friends, mm-hmm. job, but it can also come from a judge. And that's because you need a little bit of coercion often, sometimes a lot, because you're asking somebody to give up the most important thing in their life, a thing that has sort of usurped their behavioral control. But they're not zombies. And in the end, if you can't engage them and ask them to take responsibility for themselves, it's unlikely that they will ever get well. And you know, that's not unlike, by the way, diabetes in a person who is obese and having trouble losing weight, you know. But because the disease is about the brain, right, it's not just asking the brain to control appetite and exercise. The brain itself is affected. It actually does, in many ways, make it harder for these people. Not impossible, but harder. And I think what the science would tell us is not that we tell people they're not responsible, but that we have to be implacable in working with them to take responsibility. And oh, by the way, they're probably going to relapse, and so we're going to have to do it again, and it's very frustrating. But ultimately, very often, we succeed.
When you're thinking about these issues of addiction, do you also spool off sometimes into your previous life as a philosopher and think about things like freedom of will and...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, addiction is a really... Yes, no, addiction is a really nice window because it just highlights all of these issues. But what I would say is the free will issue is... you know, whether ultimately in a metaphysical sense we are free or not free is an interesting, very interesting topic that, you know, philosophy continues to work over. I would like to bracket that version of it and think about freedom and personal responsibility more at a cognitive or psychological level, right, which is... more the issue of how much, even in a healthy, normal person, are we acting automatically? You know, how much power does consciousness have mm-hmm. to intervene, to plan or cause actions, or to stop actions? And I think there is a very rich set of problems. Where there's empirical data on the one side calling into question the efficacy of conscious control in initiating certain actions. But if you look over a longer time course, I think it's really quite open how much we, in the traditional sense, are in complete control of ourselves.
What about the National Institutes of Mental Health going there? I mean, because that's another... I was thinking yesterday when you were giving... you were doing a neuroethics work, a sort of a workshop yesterday on careers at the intersection mm-hmm. of science and society. Also there was Alan Leshner, mm-hmm. who's now executive director of the AAAS, but was director of NIDA. So I'm thinking, here are these folks who've been heads of... How did you get seduced into... And Tom was here as yesterday. So how do you get seduced into running these administrative jobs?
Well, that was a strange... You know, I was very happy in my early 40s. I had a very well-funded lab. I had, four terrific graduate students and a dozen postdocs, and the scientific problems were interesting, and teaching was interesting. I was, along with a colleague, Jerry Fishback, we were, and some others, we were teaching the introductory neurobiology course for the Harvard PhD students in neurobiology, and into that mix we also had the medical students who
and
were jointly the Harvard-MIT medical students.
And you got best teacher four times, so well, obviously you must have been enjoying it.
I did enjoy it, So you've looked at my CV, I did. So Harold Varmus, who was the NIH director, decided he wanted younger active scientists running institutes, and he was very persuasive. And I think for me, what really got me hooked was the fact that the NIMH mission was of critical importance, that is the unmet medical need for people with autism, schizophrenia, bipolar disorder, and depression was enormous, and the Institute had some terrific programs, but by and large, it hadn't fully drunk at the well of modern neuroscience and cutting-edge genetics, and there was still too much of a sort of wishful idea that we could prevent mental illness by making the world a happier place. And perhaps that's partly true, but medical research institutes really don't have the tools for making the world necessarily a happier place. And there was a lot of sort of demoralization, and Harold Varmus managed to convince me, although frankly I was a willing audience pretty quickly, that it was just, for one reason or another, it was just my job to fix it. And it just seemed like a terrific challenge. And I had a wonderful period, almost 6 years of doing it.
During which time, was this a period when funding was strong, or?
Well, it's interesting, when I arrived, we were talking about science in the steady state. This was when, there was the famous U.S. government shutdown presided over by Newt Gingrich. What people don't realize is that Mr. Gingrich was a great friend of science, and that the NIH was open with a budget increase. And just a few years later, the NIH began on a trajectory of its budget doubling, which was, unfortunately, the trouble is if you double your budget over 5 years and then fall off a cliff, and you have multi-year commitments to people, that's not a very healthy state. But while I was there, we transitioned from this idea of very poor budgets into this budget doubling period. So it's certainly much easier to turn a big ship around if you have a lot of money. And I really did reorganize it, and we invested a great deal more in fundamental neuroscience, I mean, relevant to mental illness and mental health, but fundamental neuroscience that came from the labs of individual investigators. We also collaborated very closely with the Genome Institute on genetics, because there's not a single mental disorder that is genetically simple, that is, that it's caused by a single Mendelian dominant or recessive gene. All of the mental disorders, like many common disorders, result from a fiendishly complex brew of genes. And I realized very, very quickly that we were not going to make any progress unless we were absolutely aligned with the cutting edge methodologies coming out of the Genome Project.
So I ask about this because I mentioned this to you earlier, and I talked to Tom Insel, current director of NIMH, yesterday, who spoke at your meeting.
Yes.
There's a letter by Jonathan Udell in The Scientist, The sort of headline is, "We have met the enemy and he is us. A scientist proposes a redesign of the US biomedical research enterprise." Because I've heard a lot of people saying it's broken. What do you do to fix it? And there's a crisis in American biomedical research, severe competition for funding, jeopardizing careers, huge buildings being built, large projects. Fundamentally, what this boils down to is to have a situation in which the government employs grantees in situ, rather like HHMI, Howard Hughes Medical Institute investigators. They maintain academic positions, smaller labs, focusing on the science, 5-6 year period of review and so on. And you get the general point. And it's a bit like the NIH intramural patterns and so on. I mean, do you see merit in this? And
because
the Wellcome Foundation, of course, is now doing an HHMI model as well.
I haven't read the article, so I think things are rather complicated. And from what you've told me, there are some risks to that approach and some problems unaddressed. And the first problem unaddressed by this model is how we support young people who haven't quite, made their name yet and aren't
in lab care supported by these major investigators.
Right. And right now the average age of getting a first workhorse federal grant called an R01 grant is something like 43, which is just horrible. I mean, people are often very innovative. Soon after training, they've been immersed in all kinds of new technologies. They haven't necessarily formed rigid habits. Not that by aging you necessarily form rigid habits, but we should really be able to give younger people real independence and the opportunity to fund themselves. I mean, the other thing is, the issue of big science versus small science takes a certain amount of judgment. I worry about too many sort of big science projects designed top down by science managers. They can soak up a lot of funds and crowd out very smart, hypothesis-driven small science. But by the same token, there's a certain kind of big science which is a platform that supports small labs. Mm-hmm. So it would be crazy to have individual labs sequencing bits of genomes today, or sequencing DNA constructs, or synthesizing oligonucleotides, or doing certain kinds of protein work. There's just no question that very large scientific establishments, often more than core facilities though, because you need the intelligence and experience to help small labs interpret the data as well, these are cost effective, they're more accurate. So I think it's a matter of being smart. I mean, there should be enough sort of big science that is both valuable in itself, but also can support smaller efforts, and also support for small science. And what I do like in this that I'm hearing is support for people instead of just for projects. And I think the problem, if we could deal with the problem of how do you identify young people, right, who are not famous yet. I think the problem with the project mentality right now is, especially when funding is short, review gets very conservative. The easiest thing is just to find, no matter how good the scientist is, to find some fault, saying, well, he's never published in this area, or she's known for X and not Y, and not fund the project. And in that sense, funding the scientist is better.
When you were in this position, I mean, how did you deal with this comment that one hears from one's colleagues all the time? They're asking for innovation, but not too new. We just want something that's already kind of proven.
Yeah. Well, I would say that I was only modestly successful. I mean, what I did, so when I arrived, one of the reasons the job was interesting was that when I arrived, the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, and the National Institute on Alcohol and Alcoholism were joining the NIH mainstream. They had actually been in a separate federal agency, believe it or not, called ADMHA, that was the acronym. And they had their own review committees. And I was very much of the view that you get the best review and you get the best science in a large marketplace of ideas. And so I was fortunate that my colleague, the then also new director of the National Institute of Neurologic Disorders and Stroke, Zach Hall, was who didn't have to change anything, they were long part of NIH, was willing to start with a blank sheet of paper with me and with the Drug Abuse Institute, tragically the Alcohol Institute at the time, wanting to distinguish themselves from the Drug Abuse Institute, so is human nature, right, keep your silo, declared themselves allied with toxicology and not with neuroscience. But in any case, we completely redid all of the neuroscience grant review, they're called study sections, grant review bodies. And so that mixed up the people and mixed up to a certain extent neurology and psychiatry and basic neuroscience and a certain amount of genetics and psychology. And I think that was very, very healthy. But unfortunately, the whole structure of the way review occurs means that even after you've sort of broken up old families, people over a short time, you know, recreate, maybe in a bigger marketplace of ideas, but they recreate the same old habits of going on a fault-finding expedition and worrying more about feasibility than impact. And I think there is something to the project-by-project mentality, which seems to always run that risk.
Given your experience there, given what we've just been talking about in terms of the funding problems and the fecundity of the marketplace and so on being diminished somewhat, and given your role as provost at Harvard, what would be your advice to a young scientist at this point?
Well, you know, I think that a young scientist shouldn't become discouraged. I think that the sciences remain critical to the success of universities and ultimately of humanity, you know, in the 21st century. But that, you know, you have to be pretty smart about it. That is, you know, you want to be in the best lab for training that you can be in, and you have to be realistic about how well you're doing. There are also alternative careers, but for those people who are, and by the way, they can be great, right? But for those who want to go on in academic science, I think you need, above all, to find the right kind of mentorship, somebody who's going to help not only mentor you as a scientist, but mentor you in the system and help you figure out, this is so terrible because it's really gaming the system, but you got to survive, right? You know, what grants to apply for when, and, you know, what kind of papers to write. And, you know, I think too many people are looking at numbers of papers and not quality of papers. And again, so mentorship is really a critical aspect. And there's a certain amount of making it in this system, which requires not only creativity and intelligence, but also a kind of optimism and persistence. Those people who make it through, I'm sad to say, at a young age, battle-tested, you know, hopefully will be able to negotiate the system well enough that they can focus on their scientific creativity.
All right, say that in a larger picture then. You talked about the role of science in society, and we've spoken about this before, but not on camera. The rightful place of science, as the president said he would restore science to the rightful place. What is the rightful place of science?
So I think I'm, like many people, very troubled about the appearance that we live in a post-fact society, or a society that is a, to some degree, getting to be a parody of, you know, postmodernism. Everyone thought that the postmodernist would come from the left. By the way, I have no sympathy for that kind of postmodernism. But in fact, the Bush administration, by having industry lobbyists edit scientific documents, sort of may have been the first postmodernist government in human history. Science, the work of science should be accepted and respected by society. Now, before you think I'm sounding arrogant, I'll caveat that in a minute. But what I mean is, you know, there's no question, there's no controversy about evolution from the point of view of science. And too many public figures are kowtowing to a very different tradition, which might be a fundamentalist religious tradition. But we shouldn't confuse the two, right? Science, especially when it comes to something like evolution, is based not only on the fossil record, but on the currently ongoing evolution of bacterial resistance. There is evidence for it in every genome we compare and so forth. I mean, there's not a lot of doubt, and we shouldn't be sowing doubt about science. The other thing is, people should recognize that science isn't just facts in a textbook, and when one falls, it's not a falsification of science. Science is a process, and we're always going to be finding that what we believed was wrong, and you know, there's a better way of understanding it, but that doesn't invalidate the whole scientific process. Now, that said, that public figures and policymakers should respect the accomplishments of science and not intrude opinions from other traditions upon it. Scientists should understand that science by itself doesn't dictate policy. That is, scientists may have certain findings which suggest that this is happening or that is going to happen, or that, you know, a certain level of pollution produces deleterious consequences for people. Policymakers then have to figure out, you know, whether this can be sensibly implemented and at what cost. And I know many scientists hate any cost-benefit analysis because that's often used as a cudgel against things that we could be doing. But just because, you know, again, science, you know, sees an issue or a problem, policymakers do have to factor in feasibility, cost, how something gets implemented, what the side effects are of implementing it, values. I mean, there's just no question.
Whether they'll get reelected.
Well, that, you know, of course, that's, again, human nature. One wishes that they would just do the right thing. But I think that the point is, science is not, shouldn't be the plaything of politicians and lobbyists on the one hand, but scientists have to respect that they don't get the last word on how policies get set, that many other factors have to be factored in. And in some sense, right now there's a very unfortunate split between the scientific community and the leadership and political leadership and policy community.
Is the role of being provost at Harvard, how did you actually?
Well, that, so when I decided that, not enjoying some of the things that had cropped up by 2001 in the Department of Health and Human Services, I thought it would be better for me to leave than to perhaps say something that might be bad ultimately for NIMH or NIH. And I was planning to return to, I'd kept my lab and I was planning to return to the lab, but just then Larry Summers, who of course had to leave his Washington job, right? He was a political appointee, he was Secretary of the Treasury, had become president of Harvard, and he called me up and basically said, you know, this is an amazing place, but I think we're too balkanized and siloized and we're underperforming, and, you know, would you be interested, you know, in doing this job, but having as a major project helping build stronger interdisciplinary and cross-school life sciences at Harvard? And that seemed like a terrific thing to do, although in fact, the truth is it took me about 4 or 5 months to agree to do it. And despite the troubles at Harvard, which I won't talk about, we got an enormous amount done. We built a fantastic stem cell institute despite the lack of federal funding. In fact, probably that spurred on our donors, and a Department of Stem Cells and Regenerative Biology that's a joint venture between our medical school and Arts and Sciences, which for a very decentralized, siloized university was terrific. We helped elevate the engineering division to being an engineering school. It will never be huge at Harvard, but you know, engineering and practical applications of applying science is critical for any great university, and in particular, we were fortunate to get funds for a fabulous, innovative bioengineering activity, and we created a joint venture with MIT around genomics, which is, I think, big science at its best. The Broad Institute, funded by Eli Broad. So a lot of really good things happened.
I'm interested in one of the things that I gather you're working on now, which is the sort of Bible for a physician, is the in terms of disease and specifying what people have got, is this DSM, which is currently DSM-4. There's a DSM-5 coming down the pike. You're involved in all of this, aren't you?
Yeah, it's interesting. So this is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and it is used whether you know you want to get a diagnosis for treatment or insurance reimbursement, but it's also used in judicial and administrative proceedings, and it's also involved in science, in that we can't have a post Tower of Babel world where when somebody says schizophrenia or autism, you mean different. You mean something different from the next doctor or the next scientist. And so this is the manual that gives people the definitions of these diseases. There's only one problem, but it's not a trivial problem, which is that while it has created a common language for communication, it dates from a period, the formative years were the 1970s, when the science was so young that the boundaries of these disorders, and even whether, you know, there are too many of them or the world's been divided up wrong, really wasn't known. And in truth, while we know a lot more today, it is still much harder to say that there is something called schizophrenia, and you define it exactly like this, than to say this is tuberculosis or type 1 diabetes mellitus. And that's because the brain is so challenging, and we don't have objective medical tests to sort of draw a boundary around these things. Now, per se, disease classification is not very interesting. It's probably sort of like a form of stamp collecting. But when I was NIMH director, I had this early on this epiphany that we were spending taxpayer money to do disease-related research, and everybody was following the same conventions. And if they were wrong, then we were diminishing our chances of discovering the right treatments, finding the genes, finding the neural correlates through imaging of these various diseases. And that this diagnostic system, which really was meant to be heuristic, had basically become reified, had become ossified. And so I'm just playing the role of the bad boy here and saying, you know, again, we need a certain amount of humility. We can't blow the thing up. You know, we've got to keep the plane flying. We've got to repair the plane while it's flying. But my idea for this is to think about current genetics and other kinds of interesting analyses, which cluster certain groups of disorders, you know, the anxiety disorders or the mood and the anxiety disorders, or a schizophrenia spectrum or certain developmental disorders, and then give scientists permission within these larger clusters to reanalyze how they really might be better mirrors of nature. And part of it is just really fundamental. All of the disorders in the DSM are what are called categories, as if there is a natural kind, and there's a difference between that natural kind and being well, or between this disorder and being another disorder. Another way of thinking about certain illnesses is through quantitative dimensions. So high blood pressure, hypertension is quantitative and dimensional. Diabetes, glucose levels at different times is quantitative and dimensional. Turns out most mental disorders actually are not categories, but they're quantitative. So basically the goal, I think, should be to not to screw up all the poor clinicians who are out there working hard and the patients who need their insurance, but to open a clearing in the current thicket for scientists to reanalyze large clusters from the bottom up, to think about them very differently. And that will require not only, you know, creating meaningful large clusters of disorders within the DSM or the ICD is a useful step, but it has no efficacy unless the funding agencies and journal editors sort of buy into this and allow scientists to assume not that there is simple phobia and social phobia and panic disorder, but rather there are these disorders of dysregulated fear, and let's see if we can do a better job of understanding how they are arrayed in nature.
Yeah, a couple of points on that. First of all, I liked your update of Neurath's definition of science. You moved it from being a boat that you have to fix while it's still floating
exactly,
an airplane.
Yes. Secondly,
you must have heard this 1,000 times, that people's, you know, to get their insurance, as you
say,
you have to specify what's the number,
what
do you have?
Yes.
And, you know, you can look in there at certainly things that begin borderline.
Yes.
And you think, oh my God, I've got all of those things.
Yes, exactly.
So it's very fungible in some ways.
Yes,
So how have you been dealing with that in the community?
Well, again, it's interesting. I mean, part of it is that there are symptom lists, and we can all have certain symptoms in life, whether psychiatric or other disorders, but whether they rise to the level of disease comes along a different dimension, which is severity and impairment or risk. I mean, you may have no symptoms from atherosclerosis in your coronary arteries yet, but they create risk, right? So it's not just a checklist of symptoms that mean that there is disease. But it is true, people look in the book and they see they have lots and lots of things. And the problem is that, while I have no complaints about people doing their best effort in, you know, the 1970s to divide these things up, unfortunately, there was an orgy of splitting, and there are just too many disorders. And one of the reasons that people get multiple diagnoses is that probably one shared risk factor carries, you know, three or four disorder names, and so anyone who has one of them often has two or three or four diagnoses. Again, the idea of not lumping in a way that takes these disorder names away before we know better and harms clinical care, but lumping for scientific purposes to allow reanalysis, I hope will ultimately lead to there being a much smaller number of putative psychiatric disorders in the future.
Mm. Putting a number on a lot of these things is really difficult. Let me shift onto a slightly different topic, but you'll see that it's somewhat connected. If you're trying to measure somebody's, we're talking at the moment about a neuroeducation X-Prize.
Right. Yes.
And what are the neurometrics that we'd use to decide whether you're optimizing the performance of the 3 pounds of wonder tissue we all carry around with us? And you know, you can look at processing speed and attention,
yes,
sequencing,
right,
prediction,
cortical thickness,
memories, spatial skills, so,
yeah,
so on and so forth. But how do you, you know, the question would be, how do you actually come up with some neurometrics for that? And how do you, and you
yeah,
said earlier that you found neuroeducation one of the little,
yeah, there are
slightly
there are
bogus
some things,
areas.
Yeah, there's some things that are, look, neurobiology and cognitive neuroscience, which is a branch of neurobiology, ultimately must be important contributors to teaching and learning. There's just no question. It's just that people tend to overestimate how much we know and to push things a little bit fast. Now, one of the issues in these metrics is we often measure the wrong things very, very well because those are the things that we can measure. So when we measure the results of treatments for mental disorders, say for depression, we measure symptom reduction. You know, are you sleeping better? Is the sadness less? Do you have more energy? But often what the patients care about is, can I go back to work and function well? Can I go back to school and actually learn, right? Well, we don't measure those things, right? And one of the things about neuroeducation is that processor speed is important, for example. It clearly correlates in many studies with whatever G is, you know, or IQ or fluid intelligence. But in the end, it's not actually, it's not a measure that goes all the way to what we want to know, which is, you know, what are people learning? How do they learn effectively? And frankly, I don't know that there are such good measures of that. And I think it's very, very important when we, you know, look at where science is taking us and what we can measure and what we could know. We should be very rigorous, right? But we also have to look at, and this is like the policy discussion we had, what are the real implications for what people care about? What is the external validity? What is the generalizability of these findings to our goals?
And how can they be scaled?
And how can they be scaled, for sure, but don't take what is a surrogate measure or an intermediate measure and assume it maps onto success in the world, right? One of the things in treating schizophrenia with the current antipsychotic drugs is they often are very successful, at least early on, in taking away the hallucinations and the delusions, but people still remain impaired. And, you know, that's because there's also a cognitive deficit. But if you're only measuring a reduction in hallucinations and delusions, you declare your medicine a success, and indeed it is, but you're actually not to where you want to be, which is, can I work again at the level, or at least nearly the level, that I was on a trajectory for?
Did you ever consider, one of the questions I didn't ask you earlier, did you ever consider doing anything other than what you're doing right now? I mean, are you...
No, I didn't. I'm just, as you can infer, I'm an academic in my bones. You know, I've had some strange, perhaps, forays into being in the government, and it was quite enjoyable, but I just always wanted to be an academic.
Yeah, the most regular alternative we get, by the way, which you would understand, is people who say they would like to have been a musician or an architect.
Oh, well, that's two of
the most frequent.
Yes, well, it's easy. I have no talent, so I had no choice.
So, are your parents still with us?
My dad is.
So, do you think he's paid off? I mean, is he satisfied that you got somewhere?
After many, many years, he's made an uneasy peace with my career choices. But we get along quite well. My mom, before she died just a few years ago, I think, figured out that this was working out.
Do you plan to go back to the lab at some point, or you keep on safe?
Well, ultimately, yeah. You know, ultimately, I have to be honest with myself. I've now not had a lab for almost 9 years, and I don't want to delude myself and become, a useless pseudoscientist. But at some point, it would be interesting to see if I could rehabilitate myself in some way.
Let me ask you a couple of the questions that I mentioned that I always ask people. The time travel token, who would you like to bring to dinner at your table and have questions?
Well, I've given you some hints already, but I was thinking again. I'm really interested in people who were involved in major intellectual ferment. So I've already told you I'm interested in how somebody like Michel de Montaigne got to be a skeptic in the 16th century. Another person who just a remarkable impact is Charles Darwin. And it would be really interesting to sit down with Darwin and understand not only how his ideas developed, but how they expanded to touch on human behavior, right? But also how he processed not only the approbation, but the disapprobation of broad swaths of society. And it would have been interesting to hear him predict how evolution would be accepted and incorporated. I don't know what he would think, from his perch, but it's a bit shocking to be living in a technologically advanced society in 2010 and have that society contain a huge number of people who doubt evolution, deny evolution, don't understand evolution, when it's the fundamental basis of all of biology.
Hmm. What are you optimistic about at this point?
Oh, I'm optimistic that despite our funding woes, not just in the U.S., by the way, I mean in Great Britain, despite fighting off draconian budget cuts, I think science budgets are at risk. I think it's true throughout much of the world, different in parts of Asia, of course. But I think science is at a very exciting stage because the tools created, for example, by the Genome Project, new technologies to peer into the functioning human brain, all kinds of other new tools coming out of the interdisciplinary connections between chemistry and biology, mm-hmm. between engineering and biology, are going to help science move ahead. So I'm really very, very optimistic. Of course, science will never move as quickly as we hope and we need to deal with whether it's cancer or diabetes or schizophrenia or autism. But I think even dimly seen, there is some light at the end of the tunnel for many of these illnesses. I wouldn't want to overpromise, but I think that's really very exciting. I think in terms of governance and tolerance and the incorporation of science and tolerant human values, we're at a particularly low ebb right now, but any student of history knows that these things tend to wax and wane. And people are in a particularly nasty mood right now. Why wouldn't they be? The economy has crashed. People around the world are unemployed, have been unemployed for a long time. Many of these jobs are not coming back because industry has figured out how to mechanize or use technology to replace them. I'm optimistic that we'll be looking back in X years or a decade and things will feel much better. Unfortunately, we haven't figured out how to keep things stable in a good place for a long time, and they're likely to backslide again.
A little science might help.
But a little science might help, exactly.
Steve Hyman, very good to talk to you.
Good to talk to you.